The information in this podcast is alleged and based on our understanding and research at the time of recording. We make every effort to ensure the accuracy of the information presented, but we cannot guarantee that all data is entirely accurate or complete. The opinions expressed herein are solely those of the hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views of any organizations mentioned. Listeners are encouraged to conduct further research and consult professionals before making decisions based on any information provided in this podcast. For further information and full case files, including crime scene photos and case reports, please go to the link in our show notes. Viewer discretion is advised. Previously on The Stack Deck.
Have we not clearly demonstrated that each and every one of the professionals and their agencies that have been involved in this case have not only failed us miserably, but have equally participated in a conspiracy against my son? How could it be any other way? Two pathologists who effectively mutilated my son, and for what purpose? They remove all of David's vital organs, including his heart, pretending to be performing a top-notch autopsy, only to intentionally omit the most glaring protected area on David's body and the only area on his body that is not burned.
Well, it's all showing that the single witness is not reliable that way, etc. You know what I mean? That we're not comfortable now saying this is how it played out, then we would make that change.
Sure, and the single witness you're saying is his wife.
Presumably, I can't remember exactly, you know, without she's the main source of information for sure, you know, without going back and just looking at the case again.
Welcome back to the Stack Deck podcast series, episode 5, The Fire Investigators. In this episode, we'll be examining the fire investigation into David's death. In accordance with the Minnesota statutes, in the case of a fire that results in a human death, the state fire marshal is to be contacted so that he can establish the origin and cause of the fire. We will now review the state fire marshal's conclusions along with the Plymouth Fire Department's to see if they can be held to a reasonable degree of scientific probability as stated in the report, or full of erroneous assumptions and deliberate omissions. In his report, the state fire marshal states that David used, quote, the electric stove as the ignition source. This would mean that instead of using the lighter that Miss X told the police that David had in his hand as he pushed her out of the apartment, David decides to ditch that ignition source and used the electric stove instead. David accomplished this, according to these two fire experts, by throwing a towel over the stove burners, which in turn engulfed him in flames. Clearly, both fire experts have bought into the idea that David, in the premeditation of his suicide, believed that he needed two ignition sources just in case one failed. As you can imagine, there are several problems with this hypothesis. How would it even be possible for this to happen within the split second it would have to for Miss X to see just a whiff of smoke coming from underneath the door as she's running down the hall, as she has reported to authorities?
And I forgot to mention that there was, When my dog ran into the other apartment, I looked back and there was just a little trickle of smoke.
Was the apartment on fire when you left the apartment?
When I left the door, no, but I remember looking back as I was running down the hallway and I did see like a few wisps of smoke coming out from under the door.
And just as important, why would David ditch the lighter in the first place, a much more efficient ignition source, and grab a towel instead? It makes no sense. And even more disconcerting is that none of the investigative agencies reporting on David's case document anything in the reports about a missing lighter, despite the fact Miss X mentions it several times in the audio recordings.
Where was the lighter at?
It was sitting behind him on the counter.
The lighter itself, so you initially saw that on the counter behind him mm-hmm. over by the dishwasher. Mm-hmm. Any idea where that lighter ended up?
I know from my mom and talking with her that when she went into the apartment the next week to start boxing things up, she noticed that the lighter was laying somewhere over by the kitchen table, which was pretty far distance. And when she was picking up garbage and things, she had moved it onto the counter that was closer, I think, to the stove.
Interestingly, 4 months after David's passing, senior Hennepin County attorney Miss Lopez suggested that maybe David threw the missing lighter out the window. How does she even know there's a missing lighter if it is not referenced in any of the official reports? Coincidence or conspiracy? This appears to be clear evidence of both collusion and conspiracy. Why would two fire experts conclude a most improbable ignition source and not include any verbiage about a more likely ignition source, a missing lighter, in the reports? Not a peep. When you look at the fire case file, even an untrained layperson immediately recognizes problems with their conclusions. For starters, the problem with the partially burned bench that was pictured next to the wall separating the hallway and the kitchen. In one of our many discussions, the state fire marshal pointed out that due to its proximity to the stove and the right leg of the bench being so severely charred, this was critical evidence that the stove was the ignition source. This is despite the fact that there is oil spilled beneath it, which would mean it was moved after the oil was poured, as well as the corner wall it is butted up against was not burned. This hardly seems to be expert analysis for concluding the stove as the ignition source and then to omit anything about a more obvious ignition source, the missing lighter. It seems very suspicious. And then there are the items that didn't go up in flames. There's a rag that was smoldering on top of the stove that is eventually removed 30 minutes later by police. There is the jug of oil that is melting sitting on the countertop right next to the stove burners. And then there is a pristine oven mitt pictured on the floor directly below the stove. How could two fire experts theorize that David became engulfed in flames by throwing a towel on the stove, but these items do not? Even without the protected area on David's wrists, there are serious problems with their hypothesis. Here are some of the observations made by Steve Foran, an independent fire expert, about the fire and the state fire marshal's conclusions. Contrary to the stove being the ignition source, Mr. Foran believes that the fire originated in the area of the sink and dishwasher. He states that there was no evidence of another substance on the stove that would have contributed to the ignition of the fire, that there is not enough evidence to support the state fire marshal's hypothesis, and that the state fire marshal's opinion on the ignition of the fire was quote-unquote tenuous at best. Mr. Foran concludes that within a reasonable degree of certainty, David's arms were resting on the sink edge at or near the time of ignition of the fire. The width of the sink and the counter edge in the photographs are similar with the markings on the interior wrists. So how could David start himself on fire in this position, dispose of a lighter that's never found, or if you believe the experts, throw a towel on the stove, and then go up in flames? It's not just not plausible, it's submitting a false report by a law enforcement state employee in the investigation of an unnatural death. That's what it is. Let's consider some of the evidence that was overlooked in this so-called fire investigation. It is apparent that oil was poured, not splashed, over the sink. There is an inconsistent spill pattern on the countertop edge, which means something was obstructing it while the oil was being poured. And yet oil can be viewed running top to bottom from the countertop edge down the kitchen cabinets. This evidence would support Mr. Foran's theory that David was positioned over the sink with his wrists resting on the edge of the sink at the time the oil was being poured over him and when the fire was ignited. There appears to be evidence of a second pour. Oil is visibly burned in some areas and then abruptly stops, with unburned oil pooling next to it. In addition, on the counter wall next to the stove, oil is splashed over what appears to be soot that has already been deposited, meaning David had already been on fire, probably laying on his bed when the oil was poured. We believe this theory is strongly supported by forensic. It is worth noting that splash patterns on the refrigerator and the wood cabinet next to it are very low, maybe 2.5 feet high. If it was David pouring this, who was 6'2", he would have to have been deliberately bent over to avoid spilling the oil any higher. Miss X, however, I don't believe is even 5 feet tall. The fire experts make no mention of the windows that had already been opened, apparently to air out the apartment. When the officers decided to shoot out the windows, one of the windows were already open, so they only shot through the screens. This is significant because if David had opened it before the fire started, Miss X would have certainly noticed it on a night when the temperature was only 5 degrees. If David opened them after the fire, there would have been evidence of skin and blood and oil leading up to the window in the study bedroom, but there wasn't. When you factor in the solid evidence omitted by the fire investigator, there are tenuous conclusions that the electric stove was the ignition source looks even more suspect. Now let's consider their false narrative and why they would put forth such nonsense in the first place. Let's remember the context and what the investigators want us to believe. They want us to believe that David stayed in the apartment all the while burned on his entire body and wouldn't come out of the apartment, being fully cognizant of his actions because he wanted to burn himself to death. That's what they want us to believe. And the only possible physical evidence that could support such an idea is what they want us to believe is irrefutable footprint evidence. The only problem with this evidence is that it's no evidence at all, and if anything, the photos of the footprints supports our theory that David was sitting for the majority of the 38 minutes on the living room sofa waiting to be rescued. So with this scant and, I believe, purposefully contaminated footprint evidence, the investigators needed something more to build their case that David was fully cognizant of his action and could have come out of the apartment if he truly wanted to live. So instead of telling the truth, they put together a sick narrative about a young man who really just wanted to move home, live a quiet life, and work hard. Remember, David's condition was so disturbing that the rescuers that were waiting outside the apartment door were so traumatized that some took time off from work and some even went for special counseling. With that as a backdrop, consider what is recorded in the State Fire Marshal report about David's actions. First, it is reported that the maintenance worker put out the fire but did not see the man. This statement, "but did not see the man," is repeated twice. And yet months later, when both the fire marshal and I interviewed the maintenance worker, one of the first things out of his mouth is, "I saw him and shot him with the fire extinguisher." Why is this extremely important information not included in the report? They want us to believe that the maintenance worker reported to them that he put out the fire, but he mentioned nothing about seeing what he later described as the most disturbing thing he had ever witnessed in his life, really? All the investigators that I directly communicated with all asked the same question: why didn't he come out?
What would have prevented him from leaving the apartment?
And you have to understand that David, in the state that he was in, have you ever seen anybody in psychosis?
Yes.
Okay, it's a horrific thing. When we went to David's apartment that night that we got him into the emergency room, he was not intoxicated. He had not smoked any pot, none of that. And it was the scariest, most frightening thing in the world. I could have told David to jump out the window, and he would have. He didn't know what was going on. You know, you got to wrap your brain around the condition of David. He didn't know what was going on. David knew no boundaries. If I would have had 24 hours, he would have been home, and I would have said, this isn't right. We got to get you back to the hospital, David. But instead, he went there and had this gal yell at him, and she abandoned him.
How do you know he didn't know what was going on?
When he came...
Let me say this, let me add this.
Yep.
For a defense attorney and what they're going to say is, well, of course he did it himself because he was in a psychosis, he was out of control, he was doing things that were irrational and unpredictable. Now, prove to me that that didn't happen.
Looking at his autopsy, and I saw him at the hospital like this too, it's like, could the kid even see well enough with his hands partially degloved, virtually blind, and he's in a smoky apartment?
The real question is, why didn't they allow David to be rescued? Clearly, had this fact been documented, it would have been obvious that David was not, nor could have been, a threat to anyone, especially the well-protected police. Despite this evidence, the report goes on to tell us that there was a brief standoff with David. Imagine now David, who had been breathing heavy smoke for 38 minutes in a dark apartment, unclad, burned on over 90% of his body, inhalation burns, you know the story, and then they document there's a standoff.
And according to Al Harris, when I talked to him, he said, well, as my understanding, it's a real smoky fire and they couldn't go in there. And when I brought up, no, they told me they believed he was lying in wait, and he seemed to be shocked about that. And then it seems they made a very deliberate effort, and I guess this is somewhat new material that I saw in the Plymouth Fire Department report, where they say, you know, the door was potentially locked, and then they say when the individual exited the apartment, he was immediately checked for weapons. I mean, you've seen David, you know, he was unclad in the condition. That's not something you're going to check him for weapons. And then in the fire marshal's report, they said, listed in there, and this comes down from the Plymouth Police and the Plymouth Fire and potentially the crime lab, which I can't believe they were involved, but they said that there was a brief standoff. And then on top of all this stuff, you know, they included in the report that the door was locked. I mean, how difficult would it be for them to determine whether or not the door was indeed locked? And that this maintenance worker saw that they don't have that in their report. And rather than saying, my position is this, and I think it's obvious, and rather than saying, we made a horrific mistake, they immediately try to justify their poor judgment, and they even planted, we believe conclusively, that they moved a knife and a knife sharpener over by the chair as if this is the reason why.
In law enforcement terms, a standoff means preventing an official from acting, usually by threatening violence. So how could David, in such a condition, be a serious threat to anyone, unless, of course, if he had a weapon? Between the three investigative agencies, there was a total of 21 pictures taken of that serrated kitchen knife that was placed near the chair where we believe David spent the majority of the 38 minutes. This knife, as you have learned, however, had no blood, skin remnants, or soot on it. It was pristine. Clearly, law enforcement believed David was a serious threat. Why else would they go to such lengths of setting up a bunker in the doorway and refuse the fire and rescue people to go into the apartment? What happens then when David musters up enough energy and stumbles out of the apartment in his godforsaken condition and has no weapon? Rather than do the right thing and begin a thorough and proper investigation, Plymouth police planted a serrated kitchen knife in their lousy attempt to make it look like there was indeed a standoff with David. There can be no other explanation. The Plymouth police had the means, the motive, and the opportunity. If you cannot accept that law enforcement planted this knife, then the only explanation is what I call the flying knives theory. So which is it, the flying knives theory or the Plymouth Police Department? The next step in their false narrative, they report that immediately after David falls to the floor, he is commanded to crawl, and according to the Plymouth Fire Department report, He is then checked for weapons. The state fire marshal reports that David then says, quote, I could use a drink of water. If this is true, then I'd like to see how a jury would respond to such reports once they have looked at David's autopsy photos. After sitting for 38 minutes, breathing heavy smoke in a dark room, again, burns on over 90% of his body, the very last words David speaks are, I could use a drink of water. Imagine if the SEC was investigating a registered investment advisor about a widow's claim she had lost her entire savings under their management. In their response to their inquiry, the SEC determined that it was not possible for the widow to have lost her money and that the RIA had committed fraud. What would happen to the RIA? Would they lose their license? Would someone go to jail? Of course, the answer is yes. But if you are a state employee who has sworn an oath to uphold the rule of law and you are investigating the most gruesome human death, then the bar is much lower. You can instead concoct the most improbable source of the fire, omit a more likely source, overlook critical evidence, and then present an obvious false narrative, and we are supposed to buy it and move on. Am I understanding this correctly? I believe justice will be served both here on earth and in the kingdom to come, but we still need your help. If you feel the information presented in this episode warrants a proper investigation by the Department of Justice and the FBI, please do one or all of the following. Tell your family and friends to listen to the podcast and to sign the petition at change.org. You can call the DOJ and the FBI, as well as contact your local investigative journalist and tell them about David's story. As I said in the introduction, clearly, this is not acceptable conduct by our public officials and law enforcement agencies. When enough people hear David's tragic story, I believe the proper authorities will have to respond. Thank you for listening.
On the next episode of The Stack Deck.
3 days after David's passing, I was put in contact with the lead investigator on the case, Sergeant Heath Byrd. In our 45-minute telephone discussion, I explained to the lead investigator about David's mental health condition, that David wanted to end his 11-month toxic marriage and move back home, how vulnerable he was, and how we witnessed Miss X smack him across the face while he was in psychosis. At 39 minutes into the interview, the lead investigator asked her, okay, so let's go back to the night he killed himself. You said things kind of went haywire like 10:45. Not only is Mr. Byrd providing confidence and support to Miss X's claim that David killed himself, but he is also overlooking the fact that the alarm went off at 10:59, which would give Miss X 15 minutes to call 911 before the neighbor did. This time frame is supported by the neighbor living directly below, who reported to us that she heard pounding and commotion 10 to 15 minutes before the alarms went off.
Arguing, and you heard
voices yelling.
Yeah, I couldn't tell what they were saying, but they were arguing.
Okay.
And loudly going back and forth. I sit on my couch, so back and forth. And she was going up to the shooter, the loud noise. So it was a lot of walking back and forth, and not lightly, just boom, you know. And like I said, I couldn't make out what they were saying, but you could tell they were arguing. People were arguing upstairs. I heard a big boom, like somebody dropped something or somebody fell. So we just sat here, and then a while later, the fire alarm went off.
I miss him, but I have a peace that he's okay now.
Yeah.
And sucks, but I have a huge support system. So. And I should mention too, one of my best friend's moms is a police officer. I don't know where she's from. But she did come over to the apartment and help my mom go through some stuff.
It's pretty evident what happened, so it's not like a big mystery that needs to be solved. So,
it's really terrible that that it had to happen like this. But
thank you for listening. As a listener, I know there's always ways that you want to help. And there's plenty of things you yourself can do if you feel the information presented in this series warrants a proper investigation by the DOJ and the FBI. You can do one or all of the following. First, tell your friends and family to listen to this podcast and sign the petition at change.org. The link for that is in our show notes. You can also call the DOJ at 202-514-2000 and call the FBI at 202-324-3000. You can also call your local investigative journalist and tell them about David's story. We believe that if enough people hear David's tragic story, the proper authorities will have no choice but to respond. Thank you for listening and for your support.